Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
I'm Clark Wolf, president and founder of the Clark Wolf Company, food, restaurant, and hospitality consulting, and an author and a writer. Did you know that, Thomas Keller?
I knew that.
Okay. It is now my pleasure to introduce our very special guest, Thomas Keller. Thomas Keller is perhaps one of a very small handful of renowned chefs in this country and all over the world. He got his first pop of great publicity in New York City at a restaurant called Raquel, then went to a legendary tiny boutique hotel in downtown Los Angeles called Checkers, where he gained a reputation among foodies and cognoscenti all over the world for creativity and depth, for range and surprise. But later on, he moved to Yountville, California in the Napa Valley, where he took this 17-year-old sweet French Laundry from a couple that was beloved in the community and continues to be in that region, and elevated it to a new kind of dining in this country. Many people have said that Thomas has led the way, but consistently, Thomas Keller, in his books, in his bistros, in his casual and fine, refined, and extraordinary restaurants, has come back to the table with more for us to share. Thomas, let's begin a little bit with a quick professional biography. First of all, where are you from?
Well, I'm actually from Southern California, believe it or not, Oceanside. My father was a Marine, and so I was born in Camp Pendleton. Although I didn't grow up in California, I grew up on the East Coast, Northern Virginia, Southern Maryland. And my parents were divorced when I was quite small. I was 5 years old. I have four older brothers. So my childhood memory of food isn't one of sitting on my mother's knee or even my grandmother's knee stirring pots of polenta or braising the shoulders of lamb and having these wonderful aromas and things around me. My childhood memory was trying to get something to eat from my older brothers, who would usually cook Swanson TV dinners or hot dogs or things like that. And being the youngest, I kind of got what was left over. So that was kind of my experience as a young child. There were no wonderful food memories there, although as a young child and being the youngest of the five boys, and my mother being a single parent and, of course, working, and she ran restaurants when I was a child. So I found myself migrating to the restaurant after school. And, of course, where do you put a 12- or 13-year-old but in front of a dishwasher, right? I mean, you certainly don't let them be in front of a stove or hold a knife. And I learned many things doing that task. And, of course, I didn't realize it at the time. At the time, I was just filling my day and getting something to eat, really, because in the restaurant there was plenty of food.
I have to ask, what do you remember eating that stands out besides the hot dogs and the Swanson dinner?
Well, flank steak was really one of those things that I loved. You know, you cook a piece of flank steak and they slice it very thin and they put something on it called au jus, which came out of a can, and you know, some some peas, which came out of a bag somewhere. Yeah. But nonetheless, I mean, it was better than eating Swanson TV dinners and hot dogs made by older brothers who didn't really, you know, pay attention to what they were doing. But back to washing dishes, because this is really something that I want to talk to you about. The reason I believe that I became such a good cook was because I love the idea of rituals and repetition. And you think about that, you know, as a dishwasher, the things that you learn really set me up, set my stage for becoming a cook. And a very good cook, just because of that. The rituals of washing dishes, of course, getting set up and getting organized and getting everything in place. The immediate gratification, you know, for a 12 or 13-year-old, you put a dirty dish in a rack and you put it in the machine, and 45 seconds later, it comes out clean or dirty. And when it comes out clean, you go, my God, I did a really good job. And you pat myself on the back. If it came out dirty, you knew you had to do it again. There was something you did wrong. So you had this instant feedback, if you will. The efficiency, you know, you had to be efficient, you had to be organized, you had to get the dishes done, you had to get the silverware in the racks, you had to get the glasses done, and most important, you were part of a team, and you were a very important part of a team, because everybody in the restaurant really relied on you. The bartender needed his glasses, The waiters and waitresses needed their silverware. Of course, the cooks needed their china to plate the food on. So you felt part of something. And you know, as a 12 or 13 year old, it was a pretty amazing thing to be part of something and be an important part of that something. And of course, the more you do something, the better you become at it. So you have the rituals and then the repetition, which is really, really important, because that's what we do as cooks. We do things over and over and over and over and over again. And I enjoy that. I find comfort in doing the same thing over again. It's almost to the point where you've done it so many times, it becomes liberating. And you can think of other things. And that's what part of being a great chef.
So your mind wanders when you cook for us.
Yes, I'm sorry to say, but my mind wanders a lot. Thankfully.
Right, creatively. Yes. So you were a young fellow in this restaurant, and you were developing these wonderful muscles that made you feel comforted.
Yes.
And made you feel of place. Mm-hmm. How did you get to the point where you were actually doing this for a living, not just because mom was parking you?
Well, it's interesting, because I was a chef before I was anything. I went from being a dishwasher to being a chef. And of course, that's a very, you know, loose definition of being a chef. My mother ran a private yacht club in Palm Beach, Florida. Very small. We did lunch, and then we did a couple dinner parties occasionally. And of course, the chef was leaving, Richard. I remember his name, Richard. And he was really the chef of himself, because there was nobody else in the kitchen. It was such a small place. I washed dishes, and she said, Richard's going to leave in a couple weeks. Maybe, you know, if you watch what he does, you can do it. And that's right out of high school, you know, 18 years old. And of course, you know, I watch what Richard does, and it didn't seem so hard, slicing some ham for ham sandwiches, you know, cooking the flank steak. The most challenging thing of the day was making hollandaise sauce, which my older brother Joseph, who had already been cooking for several years, was able to mentor me on and train me on. It was a really wonderful day to, a wonderful part of the day was making hollandaise sauce. I asked one of my best friends right out of high school if he wanted to be my sous chef, you know. So there was the two of us, not having any experience at all cooking. We became the chef and the sous chef of the Palm Beach Yacht Club, and it was quite funny. It was 5 days a week job. We did lunch. We'd get there every morning at 8 o'clock. We cleaned the restaurant. We cooked in the restaurant. We took care of the restaurant. We had back then. We had two suppliers at the time. We had a company that supplied us with bread, and another company who supplied us with everything else, from fish to meat to vegetables to chemicals. I mean, the whole array we got from two people. It's quite extraordinary what's happened in our country as it relates to that.
We should ask right now to make sure that everybody understands. What did you mean when you said chemicals?
Well, both.
Oh,
no. Cleaning chemicals.
Oh, all right.
Sorry, Wolf. I know it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was South Florida, by the way, but, you know.
Yeah, okay. All right. It's very important to know. Well, because here you were, these two young fellas, and you were a restaurateur.
I mean, that
basically you were in charge of her.
Yeah, we had a huge sense of responsibility, a huge sense of accomplishment. I remember my first foray into trying to create my own dish. You know, we had specials at lunch, and usually they revolved around some type of omelet or some type of eggs and some type of garnish for the flank steak. But I said I was going to go out at that. And I wanted to do, my mother had bought me this my first cookbook. And I'm sure she bought it for me because it was probably the most beautiful book on the shelf. It was leather bound and gold inlay, and it was written. It's called A Treasure of Great Recipes, and it was written by a husband and wife, Vincent and Mary Price. And a lot of you know who Vincent Price was. And it was a collection of recipes from their trips around the world. And I would thumb through that book, and there was this beautiful recipe of a spinach fettuccine with prosciutto ham and Reggiano Parmesan cheese. And I said, wow, that looks really good. Maybe I can do that for a special one day. And so I didn't know how to make spinach pasta. I couldn't buy it anywhere, so I dyed it green with green food coloring. Prosciutto wasn't something that was available, so I took some dried ham. And, of course, Reggiano Parmesan, to me, came out of that little green shaker.
Yeah.
And one of our regular, you know, it was a businessman's luncheon place, and one of our regular businessmen came in, and he was very kind. He ordered it, and he sent it right back and said, could you have my hamburger?
Yeah.
But he tried it, and he patted me on the back and said, great try, Thomas, but, you know, you really need to go back to the drawing board there.
You meant something entirely different by special.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It was interesting, but, you know, that's how you learn. You know, you make mistakes, you do stupid things.
All right, is that how you learned, or did you make a leap? I mean, when did you go from mother finding you in the wings?
Well, up until this time, it was just about a job, really. You know, it was about... Don't distract me.
Oh, sorry.
Just about a job. It was about, you know, at that point in my career, and it wasn't really a career, it was about just having a job and, yeah. and working with a very close friend and the responsibility of running a restaurant and everything that went with that, it was great camaraderie,
yeah.
which was really important to me also in being a chef is that sense of camaraderie, that sense of family, that sense of attachment with people. We all decided, and a bunch of us decided to go to Newport, Rhode Island in the summer of 1976. Tall ships, bicentennial. We all got a job at a place called the Clark Cookhouse. And again, it was still, for me, it was still about that excitement of cooking. It wasn't really necessarily going to be my career. You know, I was able now to travel from Palm Beach, Florida to Newport, Rhode Island and get a job with another group of young guys on the stove working in a restaurant that was very, very energetic, very busy, you know, and the excitement and the way it made you feel after cooking, you know, at that pace was extraordinary. Yeah. You know, it was exhilarating. I came back the next year, 1977, which was America's Cup races in Newport, Rhode Island that year, and I got a job at the Clark Cookhouse again, but something happened and I was out of a job, and I went to work for a chef named Roland Hennen in Narragansett, Rhode Island. And Roland hired me as the family cook, the staff cook. And I didn't really know what it was all about. I mean, you know, cooking for the family. And, of course, I'd be using the secondary cuts, the leftover vegetables, things that were not going to be part of what they cooked for the guest. And the thing about that for me was, again, it was the immediate feedback from the employees. And they really liked what I was doing, and Chef Hennen came to me and patted me on the back and said, you know, you're doing a really good job. The staff has never been this happy with the food that they've had. And it really resonated with me at that moment, because here I was connecting emotionally with the people, with the individuals I was cooking for. And before that, it was never about the guest that I was cooking for, the individual I was cooking for. It was always about us and what we were doing and how it made us feel. So the idea of nurturing people was really compelling. And that was the day, that July, I don't remember the exact day, but it was July 1977, when I decided I was going to become a chef. And of course, then it was just this this extreme focus, whether it was reading books, collecting magazines, working as many restaurants as I could, all through my entire career from 1977, still to this day. I went to work in... traveled to Paris, France, lived there for almost 2 years, worked in restaurants there, again, setting me up for the inevitable, becoming a chef. I came back from Paris. I was the first American chef to be, the first American to be a chef of one of the great La Le restaurants in New York City. And there were always La Caravelle, La Grenouille, La Côte Basque, you know, La Reserve is where I was a chef. They were always the great French restaurants in New York City. And I was the first American to actually head the kitchen of one of these great restaurants, and then ultimately became partners with a very close friend of mine, Serge Raoul. We opened a restaurant called Raquel, Raoul and Keller together, Raquel, and that was a great time for me. It was my second restaurant, but we won't talk about my first one. It didn't last very long. That was my second restaurant, and it was a great experience. It was a great learning experience for me, and that lasted 5 years. In 1990, the stock market, you know, plunged, and nobody, the consumers or the guests were not eating fine dining anymore. They wanted casual food. I ended up moving to Checkers Hotel. Lasted there for 3 years, 2.5 years, Checkers.
Actually, and some great meals, but I want to go back. I don't want to leave Raquel.
Sorry.
No, I don't want to leave. The story is so wonderful that I have to ask you at Raquel.
My voice is not usually like this, so I'm sorry.
Sorry. It's... Better?
Better.
Good.
No.
How's that gin? Good.
It's really numbing in my throat.
Very good. Okay. It's the herbs.
It's there. Beautiful.
It's the herbs. Okay. At Raquel, you got a lot of acclaim. It had no le or no la.
Right.
Right? It was kind of straightforward in that respect. And it was at a very kind of urban center, urban physical place.
New York City.
Well, not just New York City, but on Varick Street, on Van Damme.
Downtown.
Downtown.
Right.
Before downtown was anything in the current, the way we know it now as a hotspot for restaurants. What were the things that you took from that have been useful as you took the camaraderie from your first experiences? Raquel was a very intense experience, I would imagine. First, very public on your own in New York.
Yeah.
It has its challenges. What did you take away from that?
It was a great restaurant. It was a great experience. And certainly what I took away from that was... I realized that I couldn't do everything myself. I needed to have somebody who was as focused in the dining room as well as who was focused in the accounting office. I was going to be in the kitchen. It was a tripod of people.
All right. And then you got to Los Angeles, a city that... Chef is moved by emotion, by the way. The memories are just very deep, very sincere. And now I will sing a selection. No, I won't. I will actually go through these questions and say that, as an audience, the spelling and the penmanship is quite good. Has Thomas left the building with Elvis again? I'm sure he'll be fine. If you didn't dust everything with bee pollen, this wouldn't happen. There he is, ladies and gentlemen, Thomas Keller. By the way, I actually should say, because I'm supposed to twice during this time, that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with world-renowned chef Thomas Keller, and I'm Clark Wolf. Chef, so you took from Raquel the notion that to Checkers, that you had to have these partners. You had to have someone in the office. You had to have someone in the dining room. Then you moved to Los Angeles, that is not necessarily known as a hotbed of large portion consumption. There are elements and there are cuisines, there are immigrant influences that are extraordinary, but it was at a time in the 80s where Los Angeles wasn't necessarily known. It was becoming, but you were downtown in Los Angeles at this lovely hotel. What did you take from that experience?
You know, being at Checkers was an extraordinary experience for me. I was coming home, which was considered my... It was very interesting. I had a very interesting dynamic in my career because I became well-known in New York City.
Yeah.
And the New Yorkers felt I was from New York.
Yeah.
But I'm actually from Southern California. So when I moved to Southern California, the Californians embraced me as their own, which is interesting if you know the dynamics between New York and Los Angeles. They're not very compatible. Nonetheless, in Checkers, I think the most important thing for me there was that it kind of liberated me from New York. Up until that time, I considered New York the center of the universe. This was where I was going to be for my entire career. This is where I thought everything was the best of everything coming to New York. When I moved to California, I realized that... Are there any New Yorkers in here? No, I realized that New York was not the center of the universe and that California had extraordinary raw products. And this is what really compelled me to stay in California, was the ingredients. Mm-hmm. Because what is a chef working with? When you think about cooking, it's a very simple equation. It's about ingredients and execution. And here in California, we have the most amazing raw ingredients anywhere in our country. So it's very compelling. That's why I wanted to stay in California.
All
now,
right.
I would have stayed in L.A. had I been able to find a restaurant that would have hired me. But at that time, I was known as put it mildly, as an emotional chef, if you know what I mean. And a chef that really couldn't control costs. Mm. So... I'm still emotional, but I don't display the emotions the way I used to. And about controlling costs, I don't really deal with it anymore. So I just kind of push to the side and let somebody else deal with that.
My understanding is that you've taken the generosity of your spirit and applied it to your practices, and you've just raised the prices enough so that everything's covered.
That's right. I mean, you know, it's like if they're willing to pay $250, they're willing to pay $260. I mean, no one's not going to come to the restaurant.
All right, so we.
But no, do I want to qualify that statement?
You'll get a chance in a moment. So there you are in the Napa Valley that had become, thanks to Robert Mondavi and a lot of other amazing people, this mecca for people to come all over the world and appreciate fine wine and fine living. And you took what many of us thought was a kind of a sweet 70s throwback silly town with a great little place in an old train.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what is that, right?
The train station.
Right, and a really frightening motel. And, yeah, and you infuse this little building that had its own alchemy, its own magic, with a new spirit that you on which you kept building. And I'm saying this because it's been said to me by a lot of other people, and I've experienced it. After a period of time, you renovated the French Laundry entirely, and you went from how many seats to how many seats?
From 62 to 62.
All right. Right. And right. Right, and then...
But no, it's a good question. No, it's an important statement, because to explain that is that we have 62 seats. And when we first opened the restaurant, we would do 95, sometimes you do 100 guests a night. So, you're turning the tables, you know. And if you have 60 seats and you do 100 guests, then you're turning 40 of those seats a night. And it would get quite crazy in that restaurant. It's a very small restaurant. And then I started to think, well, I want to make the food better. We want to do a better job. Our resources, the really the most amazing ingredients that are out there, you know, are pretty rare. So we want to make sure that we're respectful of our suppliers and the ingredients. And most important, we as cooks, we want to continue to do better than we did yesterday. And the only way we could do that was by doing less people. So we went from doing 100 guests to doing 90 to doing 80 to today doing 70. I mean, it's still a 62-seat restaurant, but instead of turning half or more than half of the room, we turn just two tables a night. And therein lies our ability to do a better job, because we do less of it. But now, the economic side of it,
yeah,
you know, if you're doing 100 people a night, you can certainly charge less than if you're doing 70 people a night. And of course, now it takes us twice as many people and twice as many individuals who work for us to do those 70 people than it did doing 100 people. So it's a bit of a balance.
We'll talk a little bit more about a chef owning a series of restaurants. I really do want to talk about it, because people are very interested. There was a time when one chef with his wife or with her husband, they had a one restaurant. It was 60 seats, and you stayed there until you died.
One chef, one restaurant, one menu.
Now, you were among the very first people to say that anything that comes to your back door, anything that can be delivered by Federal Express to your back door,
God bless them,
is local.
Right. Come on, you don't believe that?
Now, we're
you have to redefine local.
Well,
we didn't tell them the whole thing.
We'll get there.
Misleading them.
We're in.
Sorry,
but it got a laugh, Thomas.
It did. Okay.
Okay, but we are in the midst of a locavore sensation, and yet the most recent article I read about you, of the many, is that you happen to have this miniature farm. Really, it's not a garden. A farm across the street from the French Laundry. So you have extraordinary local produce, and you bring things from all over the world. Say a word, if you will, to everyone who cares about local ingredients, who cares about the locavore movement and being seasonal and local, but also...
being responsible.
There you go.
Because I think, Clark's talking a very important thing. And, sometimes we have a selective memory. It's like, this whole idea of buying local food or farm-to-table is our idea. I mean, I think my grandparents, was always about farm to table before World War II.
Right.
I mean, who didn't have farm to table? I mean, that's where they bought their food, at markets, they grew it. World War II happened, things changed. The 50s came along, and I was eating hot dogs and Swanson's frozen TV dinners. I mean, go figure. But in the 70s, we started to really think about what we were doing, because chefs started to become serious about their craft, and we started to search out the farmers again. Jean-Louis Paladin, does anybody know who Jean-Louis Paladin was? A great chef in Washington, D.C. He came from France. At the same time, Alice Waters started the movement out here. Many people think Alice Waters influenced chefs, but it was really Jean-Louis Paladin who influenced chefs. Alice Waters influenced everybody else. And he started to look for... he came here and said, guys, what's going on? How come you're not using, not going to the farms? How come you have relationships with your fishermen, with your gardeners, with your livestock purveyors? And he started to search those out, and he really inspired so many chefs to rekindle relationships with the farmers. And that's exactly what we do. With that said, it doesn't mean that our farmers are within any geographical radius of our restaurants. Right? I mean, you talk about local, we all think about, it's got to be within 20 miles, 30 miles, I don't know. What is the definition of local? Is it 50 miles now? Is it 100 miles?
It's 100 miles.
It's 100 miles now. Okay.
Yeah, with parking.
Okay, with parking. I mean, I can tell you my grandparents, it wasn't 100 miles. I mean, they travel 100 miles in a day and a half. I mean, for them, if it wasn't within 5 miles, it wasn't local.
Yeah.
So local is, the definition of local is really kind of arbitrary. For me, you know, 15, 20 years ago, being a chef, local was about quality, the quality of the product. You know, I was a chef who wanted to have the best products, and if I could get them in my back door the next day, that was local to me. That's what Clark was talking about. Of course, flash forward 15 years or 20 years to today, and we're back to that idea of, okay, local has to be within a certain radius. But if we did that, what would happen to so many of our farmers, so many of our fishermen that are out there, have done a tremendous job in changing the way we think about food? Take Keith Martin, for example. Keith Martin, who's our lammer, has been our lammer for, I don't know, 13 years now. Extraordinary man who has extraordinary principles about the way he raises his lamb. He has done protocol that he has had patented on the way to raise lamb. It's an extraordinary process. I hope one day that this process is adopted by the entire livestock industry of our country, and we would all be much healthier for it. But if I stop buying, he's in Waynesburg, Pennsylvania. Does anybody know where Waynesburg, Pennsylvania is? How many local restaurants do you think he would be selling to in Waynesburg, Pennsylvania? Nobody. He'd be out of business. He wouldn't have the opportunity to have the impact that he has on the livestock industry if chefs stopped buying his lamb.
All right, so, I mean, we could spend an entire evening a real sustainable construct. You're getting is intense. But we can't go much further without, and when you talk about Jean-Louis Peladon, who was a larger-than-life character, a lot of the reason that people didn't know him is that he wasn't on television. I mean, if Jean-Louis had been on television, can you imagine?
Yeah, he would be perfect for television, actually, and I never thought about that.
Yeah. So we have to say a word, and it's been asked. Tell us some of your thoughts about how this new explosion of cooking on television has either helped, challenged, affected what you do for a living, and how we as Americans think about food.
I have to qualify television. I mean, I just did TV on Monday morning, the CBS Today Show, early show with Danielle Boulud. I mean, that was TV. We taught people how to make a shoulder of lamb in an all-clad slow cooker with Keith Martin's lamb from, you know, and it was beautiful. I thought that was really good television. Are we talking about reality TV? Is that what we're talking about? I don't know. No, because reality TV is reality TV. You know, it's not real. You all know that, right? We're in Lafayette. You're sophisticated, intelligent, intellectual people. You know reality TV is not real. But nonetheless, I think, you know, the cooking phenomena on television, whether it's Food Network or Bravo or whoever else is on, you know, it brings a lot of recognition to chefs. It brings a lot of recognition to our industry. I wish there was more meaningful food television, but meaningful food television is kind of boring, really. I mean, you know, chopping vegetables and doing this. I mean, really, it has to be. We have to have drama in our lives, don't we, in order to be enticed to watching something. So that's what reality TV is. And it's a good thing. I mean, Tommy Colicchio is a really good friend of mine. He has Top Chef.
He has a lot of good restaurants.
It's a lot of good restaurants. He has a lot of fun on Top Chefs. It brings a lot of recognition to his restaurants. People come into his restaurants. He brings a lot of recognition to the young chefs that are on the show. So all in all, it's a good thing. But it's not real.
Well, some of that has gotten better. And somebody asked, regardless of intelligence, training, and exposure, do you think you have to be an inherent super taster to be a great chef?
Oh, look at that. Tea.
You have a future in the food service industry.
Generous and gracious.
That's right.
Thank you.
Yeah, where's mine?
Oh, sorry.
Oh. No, do you think that you have to be... can you explain a little bit about the process of tasting? Actually, it was written recently...
Yeah, I think you have to, I think you have to have really good taste buds. I think you have to be able to discern something that, you know, the difference between good and great. And that's a difficult thing for most people to discern, something between good and great. I admire sommeliers because they have a palate so much further advanced than most chefs have, because they're really talking about the grape varietals, terroir, the different things. Well, we're just talking about the fat content of a piece of beef.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, give me more fat, it's going to taste better. I know that.
All right. So along those lines, you started with this very refined, you arrived in the world with this very refined high-end restaurant. And then you opened a brasserie and a bakery where people could have a brilliant time, a glass of champagne, steak frites, and just have that Bouchon experience. And then you opened Ad Hoc. This is something
This is 15 years, this, these this phrase you just said. So it's not like it just happened.
But this is reality radio.
Right, it's reality radio, right.
And things go quickly and there's an editor. So, but tell us a little bit about the story, because I think it tells a lot about how the restaurant industry works. And when you talked about how you felt as a young man in the kitchen and how close you felt to your coworker, that warmth and that camaraderie, I've experienced all of the wonders of all of your restaurants, but I've never seen such happiness in a public staff, in a front of the house staff, as I see every time at Ad Hoc. How did that happen, and what is that magic?
Most of my restaurants are organic ideas. The French Laundry, maybe not so much of an organic idea as much as a lifelong goal, but Bouchon certainly was an organic idea. There was five of us in the kitchen at the French Laundry when we first opened it. We all came from urban environments, and everything in Napa Valley closed at 9:30 at night, so we thought, wouldn't it be great to have a restaurant that was open later? And that was the genesis of Bouchon. So we opened Bouchon down the street. It was open until 2 o'clock in the morning. We could all go there after dinner and have something to eat. Bouchon Bakery, the genesis of Bouchon Bakery was that, you know, as I said a little earlier, how chefs are control freaks. We at French Laundry weren't able to find the variety and size of bread that we wanted for our restaurant, for our guests. So we opened a bakery. That was that simple. Ad Hoc was a whole other thing altogether, because I had French Laundry, Bouchon Bakery. I wasn't really looking for another restaurant in Yonville. Yonville has 2,500 people in it. but we had different plans for the garden across the street,
right,
which my partners still have plans for, and they think I'm a lunatic for having a multi-million dollar garden. They can't figure out how much a carrot cost over there, but nonetheless. I bought the property that Ad Hoc sits on because of the opportunity to satisfy a requirement by the city and by the state for employee housing. Boom, there's a restaurant. And as we do many times, at the French Laundry, we'd sit around the table at the end of the night, and we'd decide on the menu the next day because the menu changes every day. And after the menu changing process, we would talk about different things that were relevant to us. And one of them was this new restaurant that we had down the street now. And I said, guys, what do you want to do? What would you do if you had a restaurant to open? And we threw it around the table, and we came up with this idea of doing a family-style restaurant. I've always wanted to open a hamburger restaurant. I'd go figure, a chef opening a hamburger restaurant. I never heard of that before. But I've always wanted to do that, but I wasn't ready to do it at the time. So we came up with the idea of doing Ad Hoc. I sent out an email to the executive staff of our restaurant group telling them about this idea. And it was actually, I sent it out on April 1st, and I never got a response. And I couldn't figure out why I didn't get a response, and they thought it was a joke. But the idea was to do, you know, a small family-style restaurant that served four courses. It was $49. Family style meaning interactive. Family style meaning, how many of you had a menu at your dining room table when you went home from school? Did anybody's mother make a menu for them that you could make a choice? So that's what I mean by family style. There was no choices on the menu. You came in, you sat down, you ate what we made. And of course, you have to have real confidence or have to be really hungry, depending, in the people that are cooking for you. So it's been a great experience, but it's about that family environment. And the reason I truly believe that it expresses that spirit and that sincerity and what you talk about, that love, that emotion, is because they are a team. We're only open 5 nights a week. They all work together. They all take the same days off together. They all play together. There's maybe 24 of them there. Most of them have been there since the beginning. And that, to me, is the most important part of that restaurant, is that team that's down there that embraces the restaurant as if it's their own. And you know, if you take something and you make it your own, how are you going to treat it?
Well, all right. So a number of people are educators who have asked some questions.
Here?
Yes.
Go figure.
And yeah. And they're the occasional student. And you know, we're teaching kids in gardens now. Uh-huh. There are many people out there who want to think about what they might do for their career. Say a little bit, if you would, about the process, other than the educational process of having your mom let you go from dishwasher to head chef, that people might consider at various stages, for young people, for older kids who might want to get involved or see if they're right for the restaurant industry, or for real aspiring chefs who want to launch a career.
Okay. That's a big question.
Well, it was three cards.
Was it three cards?
Three cards, yeah.
Okay. Well, I think that there's two really important things that I think about when it comes to being a chef, or really actually doing anything. I think number one is patience. You know, have the patience to go through the process. You know, don't rush. And we're all, I speak from experience because as a younger cook, I always wanted to find out what the next thing was. Chef, when can I do something else? Chef, when can I do something else? And he would always beat me on the head and say, do what I tell you to do and do it over and over and over again, and someday you may get to do something else. So patience, I think, is really important.
We have to ask who that was. What chef actually said that to you, Thomas?
What chef said that to me was Patrice Boilly at the Polo Lounge in New York City at the Westbury Hotel.
Okay.
So patience, I think, is really important. And also, the other thing about patience is it allows you to enjoy the moment. I mean, being a cook is an extraordinary thing. I love the idea of nurturing people. I love the tactile feeling, working with food. I love transforming it into something that is really pleasing, not only to the eye, but to the palate as well. It's a wonderful experience. So patience is important. And then the other thing that I've learned is persistence. Don't give up. I mean, just keep going. I mean, I'm sitting here today because I was persistent. I never stopped. Nobody ever got in my way. When I failed, I got back up and I started all over again. My biggest asset in trying to raise the money for the French Laundry. Now, think about this. I was 38 years old, labeled an emotional chef who couldn't control his cost, and I'm going to go out and buy a restaurant that cost, you know, $1 million or $1.5 million. I mean, who's going to give me money? My biggest asset at the time was my ignorance. Had I known, no, serious. I mean, I know it sounds funny, but had I known what I was going to have to achieve to buy that restaurant, I'd have said, no way. I'm not going to be able to do that. So, you know, ignorance is bliss, is what they say. But no, patience and persistence are really important. The last thing I want to talk about, well, not the last thing I want to talk about, but just bring up right now. How many of you think passion is really important?
Yep. Applause are a good idea, right?
Okay. How many think desire is really important? Yeah. For me, desire trumps passion all the time. Forget about passion. Passion's a great thing. Don't get me wrong. I love to be passionate about something. But how many of you have been passionate about something your entire life? Doesn't passion ebb and flow? I mean, we've all had relationships, right? I mean, that's probably the perfect example of passion ebb and flow, right? It's like, you know, in the beginning you're really passionate, then, you know, you kind of get used to the person, and, you know, passion goes down. And something hopefully comes back someday and, you know, reignites the passion. But it goes up and down. But desire, the desire to continue to do something is the most important thing to me. And if you have that strong desire, and when that passion comes, it's going to help fuel that desire. But if that desire is not there, you should probably find something else to do.
There's not a card for that. Oh, my
goodness.
I'm
sorry. I'm sorry.
Wow. No, that's great. I'm just totally distracted now.
That's hard to believe.
It's not true either. I have always found over the years that people who cook for a living, chefs, but not just chefs, people who are anywhere in the kitchen, have a comfort level that's a little bit higher in one spot or another, whether they love sauce or they love to be at the grill, they love pastry or they like whole roasted pork, the lamb on a spit. Every really good cook and good chef that I've worked with has really loved one spot, even to their detriment. And the good ones obviously try to be good in all the spots. Tell us a little bit about yours.
Well, it's different at different times of my career, I think. Certainly, you know, in the last moments of my time as a chef, being at the pass, you know, being at the pass was probably the most gratifying. The pass is where you're kind of controlling the kitchen. You're the conductor. The orders come in. You're telling everybody what to do. The food's coming to you. You're plating it. You're giving it to the servers to take out to the guest. And in our kitchen, the French Laundry, it's such a small, compact kitchen that being at the pass also allows you to touch almost every station and actually be a cook as well. So for me, that was very gratifying because I could reach over and saute a piece of foie gras, or I can help baste a piece of fish. those kinds of things. At the same time, work with the dining room team, plating the food. It's very exciting to be in that apex of the kitchen. But as a young cook, I think my favorite station was being the fish. I loved fish because it was so delicate, because in many cases, fish has somewhat of a neutral flavor. I never understood that fish tastes fishy thing. You know, it tasted fishy probably because it was old. But so fish has a very neutral flavor, and it becomes a really wonderful vehicle for sauces and different vegetables. And it's a very delicate. I love filleting fish. It's something that always just the movement of it really excited me. There's not a lot of fat in it, so never really slid around on the cutting board. So it was easy to work with. And, being able to slice a piece of fish and see that translucent, almost rainbow effect on a really beautiful piece of halibut or cod was always moving to me. I'm sorry.
No, that's good.
It's just food, I know.
Don't apologize. No, you can apologize to the fish, but you can leave me in the... Marion Burroughs, who writes for the New York Times, said that she visited your kitchen at one point and found it to be absolutely silent and still. Were they afraid of you? I mean, why?
It's probably at midnight.
No, it was in the middle of service, yeah. And a couple of times, and she was there kind of watching for a little while, and she said that your kitchen was very quiet, and that people just whispered and didn't call out to each other. Can you tell us a little bit about...
Well, we like organization. We don't like to have a lot of chaos around. I mean, I know you all watch reality TV, and you probably see kitchens where people are screaming and throwing things around, and there's fires everywhere and all that. That doesn't happen. That doesn't really happen in a really good kitchen. We try to communicate, through just normal conversation. We don't have a lot of sight obstructions in our kitchens and a lot of shelves and things, so we can communicate with just visual eye contact. We can communicate with just talking with somebody at this tone. Kitchens to me are our kitchen, and any kitchen really should be somewhere where it's a comfortable, respectful environment. Because if I'm expecting these young chefs to work at a very high level, then I need to give them an environment where they can do that. One that is nurturing, one that gives them the opportunity at the same time challenges them. I mean, it's not an easy place to work, don't get me wrong, and the expectations are very high, and when you make a mistake, you know, the first time you're kind of talked to, the second time it's you're talked to, the third time watch out. But yes, we want to have a kitchen that's respectful, one that's certainly is clean. People come to our kitchen and say, my God, I don't believe how clean this is, and I'm thinking, it's embarrassing to me because that means they've been to other kitchens which are not clean, and who wants to eat in a restaurant where they don't have a clean kitchen? Yeah. I never understood that. Yeah. You know, I mean, the kitchen needs to, we spend an enormous amount of resources, both human resources and financial resources, to maintain an environment that is going to be wholesome. Because at the end of the day, let's face it, I don't care how good the food looks, I don't care how wonderful it smells, I don't care how great it tastes, if it gets you sick, think about it. I'm just totally irresponsible. I mean, that's just crazy. So first and foremost, you know,
it's got to be sanitary. Yeah. All right. Many people have come from your kitchens. One of the things we know in this country that we've learned is that on a resume, if it says worked in Thomas Keller's kitchen, worked in Alice Waters' kitchen, that it means a number of different things. How do you feel? What is your relationship to the people who have gone on from your kitchens to their own kitchens, perhaps? Tell us maybe a success story or two, and not necessarily using names, a cautionary tale if you have one.
Well, I think, you know, there are those people who want to work at the French Laundry, and those people who want to work at the French Laundry. And it's two really different types of people. As Clark said, you know, collecting chefs' names on your resume, you know, is something that a lot of young cooks want to do because they feel like that's going to get them further faster. And I talk about that, you know, not going fast, but being patient. And then there's those who really want to work at the French Laundry to kind of absorb the culture and the philosophy. I mean, it's still cooking. I mean, you know, don't get me wrong. I mean, we're braising, we're sautéing, we're doing everything like everybody else does. We do things somewhat differently because what we want to be able to do is to work with the food in a way that's going to represent the quality of the ingredients in a way that enhances that experience for the guest. And enhances that experience for the cook. But my overriding responsibility, certainly number one, or I shouldn't say number one, but at one level is to our guests, at another level is to our, the individuals who work at our restaurant, but at a higher level is to our industry, to raise the standards for industry. So when someone leaves the French Laundry, it could be a wonderful thing. I'll tell you a story of a young baker we had at Bouchon. He didn't even work at the French Laundry. But this just goes to show you how deep our philosophy and our culture is. He was a baker, Patrick, young Mexican baker, did a great job, worked for us for 3 years, but his goal was to open a fish taqueria in Napa. And he did that. He went on and he opened this little fish taqueria down in Napa, and I went to see him because I wanted to support him. And he was so proud of his restaurant. And he took me back into the kitchen, and it was spotless. And he opened the walk-in refrigerator door, and there was the containers all lined up with green tape. And I know most of you don't know what green tape is, but it's where we, how we label our containers, and perfectly cut with scissors, labeled with exactly what was in it. And he was showing me what he learned at our restaurant, and that elevates the standards of our industry. To see that made me really proud, and I was really happy for him that he was able to accomplish not only what he wanted, his goal, but that the habits and the techniques and the things he learned at that Bouchon Bakery, not even at the French Laundry, helped him achieve his goal.
I'm going to ask you in a moment about the books that you've written, but I want to first say that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with world-renowned chef Thomas Keller. I'm Clark Wolf. Chef, you've written some books. Not only did you teach this young man how to keep plastic green, but you've written a couple of books. You've written three now?
Four.
Four.
Well, actually one. But we have four.
I see.
Yes. I know it's confusing.
No, I think you probably will. Yes.
I will.
Why did you write these books? And second of all, what are we supposed to do with them?
They look really nice on the coffee table. The photography is fantastic. You do things because you have the opportunity, right? I mean, the opportunity is there, so you kind of analyze it and you say, should I embrace this opportunity? Should I be challenged with this opportunity? Should I do it? And I never thought I'd write a cookbook. I never thought I'd own my own restaurant. And all of a sudden, I'm faced with the opportunity of writing a cookbook for the French Laundry. And I was really happy to be able to embrace that opportunity and write that book. And that book is truly my book. And I don't know if any of you have heard me speak about this before. Maybe you have. But those are my stories. The idea of having our suppliers, our purveyors, really featured in there was very important to me. Keith Martin, Ingrid Benjus, several of our key purveyors are in there because I wanted to talk about them. I think they are truly the superstars. They give us an amazing quality of product and extraordinary opportunity. I wanted to talk about the rabbit story that changed my life when I had to kill 11 rabbits as a young cook, and how that elevated my respect for food and for life in general. So I was able to tell my stories, and it's an amazing thing to be able to write a book and tell your stories. And we all have stories, and so to be able to write a book, and was certainly something that I felt very proud of. And of course, it was very successful. It was a phenomenal success. Not that it, you know, that was the important thing for writing a book, but it certainly made my publisher happy, yeah. And so much so that he said, "Let's do another one." I mean, Sylvester Stallone did Rocky VI, right? I mean, let's do it. Let's do a sequel. And I didn't really have anything else to say. I was kind of done. I mean, I told my stories. I talked about what I wanted to talk about. I have nothing else to say at the moment. And that lasted for 2 years. They kept, come on, encouraging me and guiding me to write another book. And I didn't really want to. And then one day I started thinking about it differently. I thought maybe I was being irresponsible or maybe being selfish. Because I had a restaurant down the street called Bouchon. I had a wonderful team down there. We had the production team, Susie, Deborah, Michael, David, all of the publisher. So I said, well, this is interesting. Why don't I just pass on this opportunity to Jeffrey and let him write the book? Right? I mean, why not? I mean, he may never have the opportunity to write a book. And in doing that, it gave that whole team of individuals, as well as the production team, the chance to do another book. And out comes Bouchon. And it's a great, wonderful book. And I certainly am a big part of the book. But it was Jeffrey who really did the groundwork in a lot of the recipes. And a lot of the recipes are classic recipes from French cuisine. So there was Bouchon. And let me back up a little bit, because the French Laundry cookbook, when it was published, I was handed my first cookbook. And we'll do a book signing later. And someone said, sign the book.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh my God, what am I going to say? And I started writing things like, you know, bon appetit, or, you know, happy cooking, or, you know, happy eating, or all my best. And I'm thinking, there's nothing meaningful in that. There's nothing that comes from the restaurant. There's nothing that comes from me. There's no message there. And we have a sign above our, actually it's a definition above the threshold between the kitchen and the breezeway, and it's the definition of finesse. And that's what we think about when we're cooking at the French Laundry, is about finesse. It's all in the finesse. It's all in the details. And so it became, in the French Laundry, it's all about finesse is the salutation. Bouchon, the same thing, 2.5 years later, 4 years later, someone gives me the first Bouchon cookbook. What am I going to write? I've got to write another word. I've got to write another salutation. What is it? It was easy because it was about sharing the experience of writing a cookbook with a whole another group of individuals. So Bouchon is all about sharing. And then, of course, Per Se opened. We started using the sous vide technology in a big way in Per Se. So much so that Jonathan Benno, our chef at the time, I was visiting Per Se, and he came to me and said, "Chef, you know." And I'm walking down the breezeway, and when Jonathan doesn't just point one finger, he points all five, four fingers and a thumb at you, and it's really important when he does that. You know he's serious. He said, "We have to be the first chefs to write a book on sous vide cooking." I said, "Fine, great."
But you also helped the city of New York do a little bit of
yeah,
of
we
that.
Worked with the health department of New York City on that.
I mean,
they're a bit ignorant, you know, bureaucracy.
Tell that story. I mean, okay. How did you do that? I mean, let's stop for a moment.
Okay, we'll stop for a moment, but don't let me lose track because it's all about...
I'll get back, I swear.
Okay. Promise. Do you understand what sous vide cooking is? Okay, it's a new definition. Sous vide cooking, really, it's boiling a bag. Okay, you've all heard of boiling a bag. We've had boiling a bag for years. Well, we've had boiling a bag since like the 60s.
Yes.
And the reason it never became popular was because chefs never supported it. The minute chefs start to support anything that happens in the industry, the consumer starts to see it. And that's why we have better food in our grocery stores than we had 30 years ago. Mm. But this technology is about, really not necessarily about cooking in plastic, although that's an important part of it. It's about a new tool called an immersion circulator. And this immersion circulator is a small piece of equipment that has a thermostat on it, has a circulating pump, and has a heating coil, and it maintains specific temperatures for specific amounts of time. For as long as you want, actually. So when we started doing sous vide cooking in New York City, the New York City Environmental Health Department came in and said, "What is this? You guys are cooking in plastic bags. It's an anaerobic environment. You're going to kill somebody." And, of course, we're not going to kill anybody because we know what we're doing. And that they stopped us from doing sous vide cooking. They red-tagged everything. And we worked with them for 6 months in developing a protocol is there a duck in here? Kill it. Let's eat it.
Stuff it.
Stuff it.
Tom it. Stuff it. Write another cookbook, yeah, quick.
We started writing a protocol for safe procedures in sous vide cooking. And really, it's basically a HACCP plan. You all know what a HACCP plan is? Hazardous analysis of critical control points.
So you have written.
I know it's a lot of stuff. He asked the question.
Yeah, you've written four cookbooks with your team, and one for the New York City Health Department.
And one for the New York City Health Department. Anyway, we know, and ignorance is not a bad thing, and we know that. So we taught them exactly what we were doing. We developed the protocol for it, and now that we're the example for restaurants in New York City.
All right. So two questions. Number one, how similar to writing a cookbook was that experience for the New York Health Department? And number two, you have to say a word about what molecular gastronomy and all these little foams and fuzzes and nitrogen and all this. I mean, it goes together. My mother.
It's a lot of stuff.
My mother. Yeah, I know. My mother put vegetables in a bag in hot water.
Right.
They went with tater tots.
Yeah, sure.
Right.
I mean, it's not breaking ground. I mean,
it's the same.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So there's this thing called molecular gastronomy that they're doing all this, and painting and
sure.
So what do you call that?
Well, it's molecular gastronomy is cooking. I mean, you know, it's moving molecules around, and molecular gastronomy is going on since the first caveman put, you know, a brontosaurus on the fire. I mean, but in the same way that, you know, sous vide cooking is redefined into a whole another thing, molecular gastronomy means today a new movement. And what I call is intellectual cuisine. But most of you may know of it as Nouvelle Cuisine. Has anybody heard of Nouvelle Cuisine? Every generation has Nouvelle Cuisine. Right. You know, Nouvelle Cuisine in the 70s was a product of that generation of great young French chefs. It was termed Nouvelle Cuisine, but Escoffier, the great chef of Escoffier, talked about Nouvelle Cuisine in the 1900s. Mm-hmm. Every generation interprets their ideas differently. New fashion, new music, new art, new food. I mean, no one ever thought about food before like that, but now it's Nouvelle Cuisine. But more importantly, it's intellectual cuisine. And it's intellectual cuisine, and I'll tell you why. My point of view why, anyway, is there are great chefs out there doing intellectual cuisine. Probably the number one chef in the world who's an amazing man, a genius, a dear friend, somebody I have utmost respect for is Ferran Adrián. Has anybody heard of Ferran Adrián? At El Bulli in Rosas, Spain. And Ferran was inspired one day in his cooking because he'd been cooking classic techniques, sautéing, braising, all the things that we do. And so he's basically copying everybody else, even though he may be interpreting differently. He said to himself one day, I'm going to do something that nobody has ever done before. And this is what he did. And it was coined as molecular gastronomy. So you go to Ferran's restaurant, for example, and there's a strawberry there, and there's a strawberry, and there's, you know, a little vial of powder, and then there's this, you know, liquid. And you take the strawberry, you dip it in the powder, and then you chew on it for 12 seconds, and then you swallow it, and you take the liquid, and you put it in your mouth, and you hold it for 8.5 seconds, and then you swallow it. And you think, did I get 12 seconds? Was it 8.4? did I get the experience I was supposed to have? But your initial reaction is, do you like it or don't, right? I like that or I don't like it. But you don't know if it was good or bad. You have no idea because no one's ever done it before. You've never experienced that before, so you have no reference points to it. So intellectual cuisine makes you think about the food in a way that you've never thought before, where the other food that we all know is emotional cuisine, right? Because it touches you somewhere inside. You take mashed potatoes. Who hasn't had mashed potatoes? Who hasn't had horrible mashed potatoes? Who hasn't had mediocre mashed potatoes? Who hasn't had really good? And who hasn't had extraordinary mashed potatoes? And hopefully tomorrow, you're going to have a mashed potato that's going to blow your socks off that you've never had before. But you know it's going to be amazing because you have reference points to it. And that's what molecular gastronomy is about. It's more about intellectual cuisine, something that stimulates a thought rather than stimulates a feeling.
So what do you like to cook at home?
Emotional cuisine. I mean, we base a lot of our food on reference points. And because it's so important for me to have an emotional connection to what I do. So back to quickly on the cookbooks, because
right.
Under pressure, Jonathan Benno, write a book.
Right.
I don't want to write the book. Because every time I write a book, and I'm learning this, I have to go on book tour, I get sick like I am now. I mean, it's just not worth it. Anyway, Jonathan Benno says we're going to write a book. Corey Lee, our chef de cuisine at French Laundry, Jonathan Benno, our chef de cuisine at Per Se, and Sebastian Ruxell write Under Pressure. You know, I'm involved in it in great ways as well, but the three of them are basically the project managers. And again, I'm handed with a book on what am I going to write? Well, what is cooking, you know? We talked about one equation. Cooking is about ingredients and about technique. The other equation, it's about time and temperature, right? You all have read recipes before. Heat the oven up to a specific temperature. Cook it for a certain amount of time. It's always about time and temperature. And so that's what Under Pressure is. It's all about time and temperature. Ad hoc came to be. I'm not sure how ad hoc happened. Probably the same way that the restaurant happened, just happened. Kind of went over my head. I'm sure Susie Heller had something to do with it. It's a conspiracy between her and my publisher. Somehow she convinced me to write this book. I gave it to David Cruz, who's our chef de cuisine at Ad Hoc. Michael Roman, again, the whole team is there. We work on this wonderful book, and we produce it. Great book. It's more accessible recipes, they say. It really depends on your reference points. Anyway, quickly, because I know we got to go. At the end of the process of writing the book, and about 6 months before it's published, and of course the publisher has the book at this time, we've handed it in, and I'm not really thinking about what I'm going to write in that book at the time. But my father, who lived next door to me in the last years of his life, had an accident about 1 year before, which left him a quadriplegic, and I was taking care of him. His house was next door to mine. And one Thursday, he said to me, "Son, I want to have dinner." And I would cook for him on Sundays occasionally. And so this one Sunday, he said, "You know, I want you to make me barbecue chicken, mashed potatoes, strawberry shortcake." And I got everything ready for him, and we had this lovely dinner. We, you know, his caretakers brought him over, his nurses brought him over to my house, and we sat on my back porch, lovely spring night. And my older brother was in town, so it was the three of us. Laura was there, the four of us. I think his caretaker, maybe it was five of us. And we had this wonderful, very simple barbecue chicken, you know, on the grill. And the next day, he passed away. And it was really, you know, it was, of course, a very emotional experience. But I'm sure many of you have had that experience before. But to be able to cook dinner for your one of your parents for their last meal was truly a blessing. And so when somebody handed me my first copy of Ad Hoc to sign, it was evident for me it was all about family, because that moment cooking for my father was really what it was about.
It's hard to compete with that experience.
I'm sorry.
No, it's hard to compete with that experience. But I have to ask, you've won a lot of awards. You've won stars, you've won accolades, you've won James Beard Awards. How should we think about those? How do you feel about those? Of course you love them. Of course it's good for business. We know all those things. But is there something that we can take away from that whole kind of notion of award that is helpful, not just pleasing?
Sure. The awards that we receive are for what we did yesterday, not what we're doing today or what we're doing tomorrow. So you always have to be looking forward. It's great. I mean, we love getting awards. It reinforces so many things for us. And the most important thing for me about the awards is to see what it does for the team, and especially the young chefs, the young waiters, the young sommeliers. Because I remember when I was their age and I worked for chefs who would get awards, they were like my awards. A part of that award was mine. Part of the responsibility for that award was mine. And it was something that I embraced and felt held very dear and was very honored. So awards are great, but at the same time, the ones that really have to be pleased and satisfied with the job they're doing is us. And if we're not happy with what we're doing, it doesn't matter what anybody says.
Unfortunately, we've reached just about that point of the program where there's time for just one more question.
I can't imagine what it's going to be.
Well, it may be your next book.
Okay.
With the food truck phenomenon.
Trucks.
Happening currently, would you consider doing a series, a fleet of food trucks and pocket guides to food trucks all over America? How do you feel about food trucks? And is there going
Not
to be
in this
a,
life.
Is it? How do you roll, Thomas Keller?
Well, you know, food stands. I mean, you know, street food has always been, you know, an amazing part of so many different cultures and societies. Even our own. I mean, in New York City or Chicago, not so much in Los Angeles, but certainly in very urban environments, you see a lot of food stands. Food carts in New York City, you know, are amazing. Some of them, there's a little falafel cart on 56th and 6th Avenue that, you know, people just line up down the block to eat this falafel from this guy. And there's a block away, there's another falafel guy, and it's just not as good. So I think food trucks, you know, are certainly a lot of fun. I mean, is it a trend? And, you know, trends are interesting because trends have a definite beginning and a definite end. And the last thing I want to be part of is a trend, because what am I going to do after the trend's over? But I think they're a lot of fun. I can't say that I've been to any food trucks. But it doesn't mean that I wouldn't want to go to a food truck if I had the opportunity. I just, you know, I spend a lot of time at work or talking to people like all of you, which is a great thing.
What are you looking forward to eating?
Anything right now.
And on that note, our thanks to Thomas Keller, world-renowned chef, best-selling author, and owner of numerous celebrated restaurants around the country. Tonight's program was presented in partnership with Lafayette Library and Learning Center's Glenn Seaborg Learning Consortium and the Commonwealth Club's Bay Gourmet Forum, and was underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Clark Wolf, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.